Okay, so thank you. I am very happy to be here. I want to describe some of the dynamics of what might be happening in the central regions that Norm was describing as a point mass in his inside out or infall solutions, turbulent infall solutions. And the question here is what happens to the material that is in the process of forming a star cluster when you account for the accumulation of matter and energy in rapid inflow, as well as the harassment by feedback mechanisms within the region. And my collaborator here is a first-year graduate student at University of Toronto who has been discussing with me turbulent infall models, Peter Jumper. OK, so the motivating questions I have are, where does star cluster formation fit in the grand continuum of formation events going from individual stars up to galaxies? And what parameters describe the differences that characterize these very different scales, to the extent that they can be, that you're comparing apples with apples? Thirdly, that parameters being a second question, thirdly, what are the relative roles of feedback and accretion in the evolution of a protocluster region in determining the final state of the star system that you're going to get out in the end? And I'll touch on a couple aspects of this and concentrate almost entirely on the kinematic feedback due to the stars as they form, as opposed to thermal feedback or chemical feedback. The third question, or the next to last question, is that of the relationship between the environment and star cluster formation. And the environment for star cluster formation is a giant molecular cloud. And so I want to ask the question, which GMC properties control the outcome? We've just seen a potential proposed answer to that question. And lastly, what terminates star cluster formation? I won't be able to address this, but I'll leave it as an open question, which I think is an important one to keep in mind when discussing the end phases of this process. So to begin, I view star cluster formation as part of a larger continuum between the collapse of smaller, potentially thermally supported objects, single star formation, more turbulent regions in the creation of binary and multiple stars, molecular clouds, highly supersonically turbulent regions in star cluster formation, as we just heard, and the formation of molecular clouds out of galaxies, where rotational support is becoming important in the larger scales, and galaxy formation, what we've been hearing a lot about in this conference. Interestingly, both the ends of the spectrum include disk-like rotationally supported phases. And it's an interesting question to ask yourself, what is it that allows for rotational support in the formation process at the two ends of the spectrum, although it's not guaranteed, at least not in galaxy formation, at all phases of the process, as we've, again, heard about several examples in the course of the conference. A sort of poster stamp of the type of region that I'm particularly interested in would be the Serpent South protocluster. Here we see filamentary molecular cloud material, which has been shown to be falling towards the star cluster at a speed which is interesting. And within the depths of that potential well is a newborn cluster of stars and a variety of interesting feedback mechanisms which are playing out and affecting the result. Okay, so what are the parameters that you want to have to describe this problem? It's always a good idea to start with your list of, at least simplified list of parameters. This is a large dimensional problem, but you clearly have some region which is growing a star cluster. It can be idealized with a mass, a radius, and a velocity dispersion at any one time. So it has a virial parameter. There's matter flowing into it at inflow rate, and that determines an inflow parameter, which is you can normalize to the current velocity dispersion of the region, and therefore is sort of related to the rate of inflow compared with the dynamical collapse rate of the region in its current state. If there's an angular momentum scale in the inflowing stuff, then there's a rotational parameter, which has to do with the rate of growth of the region relative to the orbital period it would have at that angular momentum, specific angular momentum scale. If it's losing material, it can have an efficiency parameter in the sense that its feedback effects may be causing it to lose mass along the way, so that the central point mass or the central mass is not the the time history of all the inflow from larger scales. And because it's likely to be forming stars at a healthier rate than a giant molecular cloud, it's a good idea to keep the gas fraction as a non-unity factor, and to think about the star formation rate per freefall time of the region as it's evolving. And then these will be somehow related to properties like the Mach number of the turbulence. And governing everything is the growth rate that is the sort of power law of the mass of the region, or the ratio between the recently arrived material and the average rate of inflow. Okay, so this list of parameters is kind of long. It's important to note that only a few of them are really input parameters. These things that have to do with the inflow rate are input parameters. The mass accumulation power law is an input parameter. The turbulence, which comes into a couple of these parameters, one, two of the parameters, is accounted for by the velocity dispersion of the region. And this is something that's going to respond to the internal dynamics. And whatever it is that stirs or energizes the motions, as well as the turbulent decay and the effects of forming new stars. Okay, so you can rework a number of the dimensionless parameters into other ratios you might be interested in. For instance, the Kepler radius of newly arriving material compared with the current radius of your protocluster region is this. It doesn't mean much, but these numbers have values over the course of the cluster formation process. There's a certain number of Bonner-Ebert or Jeans masses in the growing region, which again is a function of the dimensionless parameters. Why do I bring this up? Well, first of all, I just like to make dimensionless parameters. And secondly, I bring it up because in the context of single and binary multiple star formation, the dimensionless parameters of the problem map onto the outcome of a self-gravitating collapse. So this is an example from Caitlin Crowder's PhD thesis in 2010, where what she did was to create axisymmetric rotating infall problems, which are perfectly initially axisymmetric up to machine precision, but develop into these highly non-axisymmetric states because of the outcome and saturation of gravitational instabilities. And she was able to the extent that numerics would allow, make a division between the outcomes in terms of single star formation, multiple star formation, binary star formation, as functions of the rotation and inflow parameters, which I've rewritten in the definitions of the previous slide. And you can see a variety of outcomes on this plot, and the star cluster formation is somewhere off in the lower right. And the question is, what other parameters distinguish star cluster formation from these multiple star formation environments? In particular, because the initial conditions are axisymmetric, these are all disky, even when they're multiple. So obviously, non-axisymmetry is an important additional parameter. Now, having written down these parameters, I think it's useful to ask the question, is there a phase of star cluster formation where they're effectively constant, where the whole thing is evolving more or less self-similarly, or at least the important parameters are self-similar? So is there a period of the creation of a star cluster during which the comparison between recent and past star infall, the virial parameter, the inflow parameter of the region are essentially fixed? And other parameters, for instance, we know that star cluster formation is not highly rotating, isn't that disky. These other parameters are effectively negligible or at least constant. And other things that you might be interested in are either constant or varying slowly. And if there is, then you get all sorts of interesting results out about the properties of the system during the formation process and what you're left with after the process is over. For instance, it evolves with a constant gas mass fraction, and it evolves to create stars that have a particular power law distribution of phase space density in their orbits, which would then be preserved into the final state if there were an adiabatic relation between those two things, which there isn't, but yeah. Okay, so that's an interesting state, and I think it probably describes some phase of star cluster formation insofar as stars are forming in the presence of continued infall. But you have to ask the question, if there is such a state, how does it maintain itself? What's maintaining it? Well, in the description that Norm Murray just gave us, the interior of the infall onto the star cluster was effectively a potential well. But I just described it in terms of an equilibrium object which is growing along with its accreting mass. So there are two options for how to maintain such a structure. One of these is to drive turbulence in the inner region due to the incorporation of kinetic energy from the infalling matter. And there's been a lot of discussion of the importance of this effect. I want to just highlight a study that I was involved in 2011 in Nathan Goldbaum's thesis, in which we took a dynamical virial theorem approach to the evolution of a giant molecular cloud. We had feedback from H2 regions in somewhat like some of our earlier works. But importantly, we also had an incorporation of kinetic energy from the turbulence, from the accretion, which we parameterized by an efficiency parameter. And in a numerical experiment at the beginning of the project, Nathan did this experiment where he turned off all of the feedback effects and drove the turbulence within the cloud purely by accretion and varied the efficiency parameter. So at low efficiencies, your cloud basically loses its turbulence and collapses in a bit more than an initial freefall time, but not very long. And then as the efficiency parameter is cranked up, you get to a phase close to 100% efficiency. You don't lose any energy from the incoming material before it gets incorporated into the turbulence. You get a period of extended growth. But any finite efficiency, you get a period of slow growth followed by a collapse. So it's not very encouraging. Of course, it's only a basically zero-dimensional model, but it's not very encouraging for the maintenance of a self-similar growing state. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not possible. And so what I've done since then is to assume a self-similar state and go back to those same equations, which go from ODEs to algebraic equations, but complicated, and search numerically for solutions of self-similarly growing clouds. And I did find some. It's not easy, and I'm not confident of these results yet, but I found some solutions at high values of the entrainment efficiency. So as long as you entrain kinetic energy efficiently, you can maintain turbulence within one of these regions and have a cloud which grows along with its environment. I do not know if these solutions are stable, and Nathan's numerical results are not that encouraging in that respect. But quite possibly, it can happen under certain circumstances. Certainly, if the stuff coming in is a bunch of stars, there's no problem. Then there's no turbulent decay. There's no problem in training energy. You have perfect energy conservation. That limit has to be a limit of these dynamics for zero turbulent decay. But there's another effect which happens during the growth of the cluster, and that is the formation of stars within it. And as the stars form, they emit these protostellar outflows that are an intriguing and potentially important form of feedback that will then affect the evolution of the growing object. So there's a long history of theoretical, observational, and numerical work, including by a couple of the people at this conference. So see Christoph Federoth's poster on this. There's a long history of arguments, some of which are by me, that these effects are probably important in star cluster formation. So here are the basic points about protostellar outflows. First of all, they accompany all the star formation. They appear to be ubiquitous signposts of star formation and accompany low-mass as well as high-mass stars. So in a sense, you can't get away from them. As a result, they precede and probably precede and definitely outnumber the massive stars that they're going to accompany. And so they are present even when you're not forming massive stars. They coincide in time with the formation of the stars. There's no lag between the accretion of material onto the stars and the emission of the protostellar outflows. And so you don't have, in a sense, what you have is feedback on demand that just dials with the star cluster formation rate. The faster you form the star cluster, the more feedback you get. They, in fact, emit far more momentum than starlight, but only during the phase in which they're actually active, which is on the vicinity of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 years. And so they are, although vastly outweighed by starlight in the end, while they last, which is the cluster formation phase, they are not negligible. And they're highly collimated by magnetic fields. But because their collimation is by magnetic fields, they also exert a force at wide angles from the outflow axis. And this force at wide angles is not actually negligible, as you might assume. I can explain why, but it's complicated. And finally, they don't go out forever. But they do travel easily about a 0.1 parsecs, even in the dense environments of star cluster formation. And so they couple well with the gas where it actually matters in determining the final state of the star cluster. So just to make the point here about the outflow momentum being much larger than the radiative momentum, here's a compilation of the two by Wu et al. 2004. This is outflow force derived from carbon monoxide, radiation force derived from infrared luminosity, or SED fitting. And there's orders of magnitude difference. How many orders of magnitude? It's probably 1, 2, 3, 4 orders of magnitude at the low end and a couple orders of magnitude at the high end between the force of the outflows and their central luminous object. And this has long been taken to be the smoking gun for magnetic fields and the launching of these objects, as is the collimation. So here's some pictures of protostellar outflows doing their thing to different regions. In BHR 71, a region forming a small number of stars, I don't know if it's one or two or something, and NGC 1333, where there's an entire cluster of stars being formed. And you see the overlap of these many outflows. Now, there's a critical parameter that matters in the coupling between outflows and their environments, and that's the mean momentum per stellar mass, what I'll call VOF. And if that is small, they don't matter that much, despite the visual appearance that they do. And if it's large, then they are potentially dominant. So if you want to consider the combination of driving by accretion and the driving by outflows, you want to make some estimate of the relative magnitude of the two forces. Here's an estimate of the relative magnitude. What I'm doing is I'm taking the surface gravity of the clump as it's evolving, the inflow force per unit gas mass, which is a sort of estimate for the maximum acceleration scale you can get from the infalling matter, and the outflow force per unit mass, which is just the direct radial force that you have from the outflows, which is slightly different from the effect of their stirring up of the turbulence. But it gives you a sense of the relative scales. Now, this comparison, if you evaluate it for regions like NGC 1333 or even the Orion Nebula cluster, gives you roughly 1-to-1 scalings, where the surface gravity is a bit higher, inflow is of order unity, and outflow to inflow is roughly unity, but it does depend upon the star formation rate and the characteristic scale of the outflow momentum, as well as a weak power of the inflow rate. So I've normalized here to 30 kilometers per second, one per 30 freefall times for star formation rate, and an inflow rate that corresponds to the creation of the Orion Nebula cluster. But obviously this ratio can change. And so that means that the relative importance of the two scales is likely to change just for this reason alone. Now, if you wanted to have a more complicated understanding of the effect of the outflows, obviously the next thing to do is to jump from order of magnitude estimate to full three-dimensional simulations like what Stella and Christoph are doing. Rather than do that, I can give you a one-dimensional model because one is better than zero. And then you can tell me if I'm wrong. So a one-dimensional model is one in which you try to establish a self-consistent Linewood size relationship for the local turbulence within the region affected by the outflows. And if you really want to do this well, to mimic what you're going to see in a three-dimensional model, you have to account for a number of things. You have to account for the fact that the Linewood size relation gives you basically the confinement scale for any individual impulse of momentum. And the impulse of momentum is feeding the turbulence, and so there's a self-consistent calculation that you have to do. So you have to be careful about that. So they interact with one another and the influence of one another. They also are coming from a wide distribution of strengths. There's a distribution of strengths between the axis and wide angles. There's a distribution of strengths coming from the mass function of the stars that are being created. So there's a broad distribution of how strong these impulses are. And you really don't want to ignore the escape of both mass and momentum along directions where the outflows are really, really strong. And finally, because I want to be talking about a context where there's inflow driving as well as outflow driving, you have to account for the fact that there's an externally driven cascade, i.e., in this case, accretion, and that will, in addition, overwhelm or confine the outflows on their way out. Okay, so here's an equation from a paper I did in 2007, which attempts to account for all of these phenomena. And it gives you a steady state, one-dimensional line width size relation that includes the effect of inflective external turbulence, some coupling constant, escape of momentum away from the region, and a distribution of momenta that merge with the turbulence at different radii. So that may be imaginary, but it is at least based upon relatively robust dimensional scalings for the way these things have to interact with their environments. Okay, so what you get out in this case is the outflows will travel out to some distance, and then in the absence of any external cascade, you only have local generation of turbulence, so your line width size relation becomes flat at large radii. Now, one of the things you see here is that the collimation of outflows drastically enhances the amount of turbulence that they can provide and also increases the distance that they travel. And both of these effects are important in ensuring that they're actually coupled to the motions of the protocluster forming regions, because otherwise they would be confined on even smaller scales. However, because the regions are finite, and there's a particular ratio of the strength of the outflow, strength of a typical outflow to the one that will unbind the entire region, there's a particular value for that, there's a loss of momentum. So as the region gets smaller, more and more of the momentum gets away, and you don't drive the environment, the turbulence as much. So basically, the upshot of all this is that thanks to the effects of collimation, the simple estimate you get from dimensional analysis is really pretty good. in terms of how strong outflows are in driving their environments. And if you conclude all of these things together, you can include the inflow term, the external driving term in the equation that I showed you. You have a cascade from larger scales, which is really the driving due to accretion, which maybe happens here. And then you have the driving from outflows on smaller scales that are either dominant in the case of a weak external cascade or subdominant in the case of a strong external cascade. And I just want to point out this point, that Norm gave us a reason that there should be a flattening of the Langlet size relation in regions which are condensing towards star cluster formation regions. And I'm showing you a reason that there should be a flattening of the Langlet size relation. This slope is the Larson's law relation. So there's a flattening of the Langlet size relation in regions where local feedback is becoming important in the formation of the protostar cluster. So there's reasons for flattenings on both ends. Okay, so there's a couple important points about this division and the question of whether the feedback by the protostellar outflows is relevant in the context of an accreting system. First of all, I don't understand the accretion driving of turbulence well enough to know how successful it is and how much it will, how susceptible it will be to an additional source of energy. And I strongly suspect that the addition of momentum due to local driving of turbulence will strongly modify the outcome in terms of the dimensionless parameters that I showed you at the beginning that have to do with the velocity dispersion of the growing clump. Secondly, the outflow driving on its own may not be strong enough to be important. In a sense, if the outflow momentum scale per unit mass is too low and you have a high surface gravity, they'll just always be overwhelmed. And another way to say that is that for any region, there's an equilibrium size where outflow driving can balance the gravitational, the dissipation of turbulence and gravitational contraction. And if you're inside that balance, then it's not good. And along that point, the outflow-driven equilibria, even when they do exist, they are not energetically stable. If you expand relative to that state, you tend to keep going. And if you contract relative to that state, you tend to collapse. And as a result, I think that quite possibly the two effects actually need each other to give you a plausible final outcome. Oh, and there's an asterisk here that I just wanted to point out for Eve's benefit, that this point that the outflow driving equilibrium is not energetically stable is quite different from the case that you'd have if you had rotational support, as in galaxies, because in three-dimensional collapse, you don't have the stabilizing effect of rotation to give you a definite stable answer. Okay. So let me just mention that there's a variety of possible scenarios you can adopt for the accretion of material onto your star cluster region. And I don't know what happened to my number here, but Norm Murray just gave us a reason for the growth rate parameter to be 2. Now, there's, along with this range of formation scenarios, there's a general trend towards higher virial parameters in the environment, more turbulent environments on the left, and less turbulent environments on the right. And the correlation between virial parameter and local density or column density tends to favor low virial parameters in the regions which are collapsing down towards molecular protocluster regions. So Norm's model would be an example of that, as would filamentary infall. So let me just go through a couple results for the case of a filamentary infall onto a protocluster, which is what Peter Jumper has been thinking about. So here's the Serpent South cluster. If you calculate a characteristic mass per unit length of the regions which are heading down towards it, imagine that you had a roughly equilibrium filaments in the initial conditions with no cluster there to start with, and you'd have a constant mass per unit length, which gives you a constant infall rate. So you get a constant infall rate in this case as opposed to an m squared infall rate, which is in the range of a couple hundred solar masses per year. And that is comparable to what you actually see in the cluster, 90 solar masses per year forming in stars, more being ejected, and some in gas mass as well. The protocluster should have a, in that case, a velocity dispersion in its central region, which is a bit higher than the velocity dispersion which is supporting the clump, the filaments that are falling into it. And this gives you an answer which is a bit high for the velocity dispersion of this cloud gas relative to the observations, unless you adjust these parameters to make the infall rate match what it ought to be. So it appears as though there's rough consistency in that regard. OK, so let me just finish with some conclusions and further questions. So my conclusions are that clusters inherit their properties from giant molecular clouds primarily via the accretion history and dynamics of whatever cuts off the cluster formation process. The feedback and accretion conspire at some level to establish the dynamical structure of the region as it's forming and after it's formed. And of the feedback effects, at least for low mass clusters like Serpent South, NGC 1333, and things up to the mass of Orion, it's pretty clear that the input of momentum from protostellar outflows are the only relevant feedback mechanism, at least until a significant massive star has been formed. Which raises the question, what ends cluster formation when you wind up with a lower mass object? And why are molecular cloud and cluster formation not disky? I have some thoughts on this, but we should save it for later.
OK, let's thank Chris. Chris, just a quick comment. So in all the simulations that we've done where we've been including outflows for several years now, going back to the work with Charles Hansen and Cunningham, in turbulent flows, outflows don't stay collimated. They become very messy, and they find paths of least resistance in between the very strong, dense sheets and filaments that are present in turbulent flows. So
I can say three is better than one. It's still better than zero.
Oh, I agree. Okay, let's open this up for questions. Mark.
Hi, Chris. I was just going to comment that for the importance of this, it may be important on galactic, it may be important on galactic scales too, because we know that the cluster mass function, dndm, is m to the minus 2, as I think you pointed out earlier, right? And that means that something like half of all, at least, star cluster formation is taking place in clusters that lack O stars. Right, by, you know, if dndm goes like m to the minus 2, then it's equal mass per logarithmic bin, and the limits are such that half the mass is in things that are smaller than Orion. And so this is, you know, half the star, for half the star formation, this is the feedback mechanism.
I wanted to bring this up in discussion, but it's an important point. If you think about this in context of what Norm has just presented, that model requires, in a sense, an inflow at all radii as the initial conditions. But it's turbulence. If there's outflow at some radii, you'll quench the inflow, I would assume. Norm maybe can comment on this. And then you'll be left with whatever you had up to that point. So you're not guaranteed to eat up your entire cloud, even in that model.
OK. Further questions? Impossible. There are no further questions. Patrick.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, I've been playing around with these things as well. And I would just like to stress that this, the accretion rate is something which is quite important. And it's probably interesting to try to put more effort on that and see whether we can come with a generic law, because it's really, if this accretion-driven turbulence is at the end of the day really important, we need to understand better this accretion and whether there is some kind of universality. The point is that in that case, it depends also on the surrounding medium. Yeah. So it depends on how much mass you have and well, how it collapsed, you may say gravity, but the reservoir of density, which is outside. So whether there are fluctuations on this accretion rate is something that has to be considered.
Let me mention another thing which is important in the context of the previous talk, or two talks ago, Norm's talk, is that this feedback mechanism will reduce the central depth of the potential well significantly relative to what you would have if everything just wound up in the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. You lose half or two-thirds of your material, you're going to have a different outcome in terms of the, I mean, it's still the same scaling, but a different outcome in terms of the structure.
Chris, on your filamentary accretion, your analysis was for along the filament, was it? The numbers you gave?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just assuming that the filament is not accreting from the environment and is given in some initial conditions and falling towards the...
Because that would be, you know, in the simulations and in observations from Helen Kirk, you see these huge flows joining the filament, coming perpendicular.
If those dominate, then I don't think the filaments matter, and you're back to a turbulent scaling.
So you bring in, that was my point. You bring in a large, very large accretion flow, and that should create a very turbulent film. The other thing, too, is that the filament is if a filament is at the interface, joining point of two oblique shocks, which simulations and theories might suggest, then there's an origin of spin and angular momentum. These filaments should be spinning, and that angular momentum might be an interesting correction to your stability arguments.
It can't be that important if they're not spinning fast enough for Keplerian support to be important on the scale of the filaments.
Further questions? Okay, let's thank Chris again. Is Mike Fall. And Mike is presenting Formation and Evolution of Star Clusters.